Good afternoon, Tech Days. My name's Adam Gilmore. I'm a Microsoft Solutions Architect working at Microsoft in the UK. I'm also a Visual Studio ALM Ranger. I don't know if you haven't heard of them or you have, but what it is, it's a team within Microsoft and including MVPs and partners that work on producing out-of-band solutions for Visual Studio. So we typically work with the product group. We have members from the product group and from Microsoft Services and from partners, and people like yourselves are part of that team. And we tend to fill the gaps between Visual Studio product releases with either enhancements to the tools or advice and guidance. So there's currently several projects running around things like lab management guidance and things like writing plugins for Word to connect it to TFS, and they'll be arriving soon. There's a link on the last page to our home site on MSDN, so it's worth dropping by there and seeing what guidance and tools we've got. So what's this session about? It's about lean software delivery, specifically using Kanban or Kanban and Visual Studio Team Foundation Server 2010. What I hope you get out of this, really, the first thing is to understand what Kanban is, if you don't already know that. The second thing is to know how it works, the sort of mechanics of it, and to understand the benefits of using Kanban in your software delivery lifecycle. The other sort of TFS bit of it, the Visual Studio bit of it, is understanding how you can configure TFS 2010 to support a Kanban process, and really to use the metrics and the data that TFS gives you to improve the predictability and performance of your team and your software development process. So that's what I hope you get out of today. So why is it important? So I like to call out two things here first. What do we mean when we talk about agile? So agile is about moving quickly and easily. That's the dictionary definition. Whereas lean is having no surplus flesh or bulk, not fat or plump. So just like me. So the way I like the term agile, it's about building the wrong thing right. It helps you avoid building the wrong thing right. So typically the old waterfall way, you would spend 6 months doing requirements and then another 4 months doing design and another 12 months building it, and then you ship to the customer and it's the wrong thing. It was possibly the right thing when the requirements were drawn up, but the world's changed. And really agile and Scrum and the other agile methodologies are really there to help you avoid that. So you build in small increments, you get feedback from the customer, you learn continuously. I like to say that lean focuses on building the right thing, but just better, delivering it more efficiently. So really what lean and Kanban, where they come from, and I think why they're important, there's been a movement in the last, well, really since about 2001, for looking at other industries and how they produce what they produce. And really lean and Kanban come from lean manufacturing and things like the Toyota production system, where they focus on demand, value, and flow. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's more of a philosophy. What we try to avoid in software development is to take the practices from Toyota, you know, how they make a car, because it's not applicable to software development, a lot of it. It's really taking the philosophy. Another thing that I think that Kanban is very good at, and lean generally, is that it helps stop emotional resistance to change within organizations. So if you're going to roll out Scrum, I'm a consultant, so I typically go into enterprise customers and I roll out Scrum. And you typically go to a project manager, you know, he's been delivering projects successfully for 25 years, and you say, you're not going to be a project manager anymore, you're going to be a Scrum Master, and that's different. You know, even though he's been successful, you'll get emotional resistance from that. It's not good enough just giving them the Scrum book and say, well, here you go, project manager, go and learn that, do a certified Scrum Master course, come back, and then live the dream. It doesn't work like that. You'll get emotional resistance. And what lean and Kanban, I think, do is make it easier for organizations, typically traditional large organizations, to gradually move towards being lean and agile. Another thing that Kanban does is it explicitly supports specialisms. So if you've got a database architect or a DBA or a UX designer, you can model their workflow in Kanban. Typically in Scrum, it's just the team. It doesn't explicitly recognize specialists, even though the best Scrum teams, they have specialists. So Kanban can explicitly support those, again, going into an organization. if you've got specialists, you don't want to say you're not going to be a specialist now. You're going to be a generalizing specialist, and you're going to be coding and testing and, you know, designing and doing everything. So, you know, you get resistance from that. One way of describing this whole thing is that Kanban and Lean are more evolutionary change than revolutionary change. So Scrum is revolutionary often, whereas Lean does it gradually through continuous improvement. So when I'm describing Kanban to people, often people have heard of it. If they've worked in manufacturing, they've probably heard of it. If they've worked in, you know, agile development shops, they've probably heard of it. But there's typically four meanings to the word Kanban that you hear, and I'm just going to quickly talk through those. So the first one is its literal definition. So it's a Japanese word. I think it's pronounced Kanban, but it's I call it Kanban. And it just means visual card or signal card. And you get one in a coffee shop in Starbucks. It's a visual signal with the order on. That's the order from the customer. That's a Toyota Kanban card there. So that what that's used for by Toyota is when they have to resupply parts, that's passed up the supply chain to the parts manufacturer, and then they supply those parts just in time. And a Batman, you know, it's a demand from a customer to a supplier, Batman, that we want supply of that demand. They're just Kanbans, really, signal cards. So the second type of Kanban is when you talk about Toyota, there's a Toyota logo at the top and the Toyota, and what it is, Toyota used that in their Toyota production system to effectively build cars at the rate of demand. What they didn't want to do is have massive inventories of stock hoping someone's going to order a Toyota. As soon as someone orders it, it triggers supply chain upstream to the suppliers, and they supply the parts. It's not as simple as that, but that's effectively it. It's just in time. And they used it to minimize inventories, so they didn't want to hold a million, you know, wheels in a factory waiting for someone to order a car. They wanted to order from their suppliers just in time. And the Kanban cards really used to signal to those suppliers or those upstream activities to deliver more. We need delivery now. And it's that key part of the Toyota production system. And really, when Toyota production system was studied in the late 70s, early 80s in the West, they couldn't call it Toyota production system because Ford wanted to do it. So they effectively called it lean manufacturing, or lean manufacturing. And that's where the lean word comes from. It's based on Toyota production system. So another place that you see this second type of Kanban, is in Starbucks, and it's used to absorb variation in demand. So if you're a coffee shop and you've got a queue of 20 people and your cashier takes the order, then goes to the coffee machine, makes the order, comes back, gives it to the customer, next please, you're going to start losing customers. It's quite inefficient. So what they want to do, they want to split the work into two queues, one with the customer queue. They want a cashier to take the money in the order. Then they mark the order and pass it up their supply chain to their barista. And that sits in a queue. And the barista then makes the coffee at the rate based on the capacity. How many baristas have you got? And it's interesting in a coffee shop, if you watch it, when there's no queue of customers left, the cashier will then switch to helping the barista, hopefully. They might get milk, or they might help make the coffee if they can. And really, it's designed to focus on the end-to-end flow of the transaction from taking the money to delivering the coffee in the most efficient way. It's very customer-centric. So the next type of Kanban, and this is really where it gets into software development, is when you start using it as a process management tool. So the same way we use Rational Unified Process, or we use Scrum, or we use DSDM, or one of the other sort of agile variants or other processes, it's really there for managing process. Now, I've got there's a Kanban board up there, very simple one with sticky notes and magic whiteboard. There's three principles around this process management tool. The first one is to make the work visible. So don't hide it in a computer. Get it on a screen. Get it on the wall. To limit the amount of work that you take on, limit work in progress. And I'll talk about why this is important on the next slide. And then to help the work flow. So like in the coffee shop example, the cashier moved to help the barrister because it was all about the end-to-end flow from the customer's point of view of that coffee cup. So why is visual management important? So it gives the whole team a common view of the project and the problems. I don't know if you've ever, if you guys do stand up and agile and scrum, often you'll do it, if you're doing it right, you're doing it next to your scrum task board. But I've seen a lot of teams that have a go to a room in the morning, and they all meet there and they go stand in a circle and they go around saying, what did you do yesterday? What are you doing today? Anything impediments? And people start to turn off. There's nothing to tie them together. There's nothing to give them focus. So one thing that I've seen was when you use this visual management, and this is part of Scrum as well, visual management, it makes stand-ups very much more efficient and effective. But in Kanban, they work differently. You don't go around each person saying, what did you do yesterday? You tend to look at the work. If I go back to the last slide. You start at the right-hand side, which is the sort of done end. And you work back from right to left, and you discuss the actual work rather than the people, which is a subtle but important difference. You see stand-ups moving a lot quicker, and you can have them with a lot more people in typically than a Scrum stand-up. So the flow end of things with Kanban, you limit the work in progress. You focus on shipping small things end-to-end through your process. That might not be into production, but it might be the nearly there bit, you know, the pre-production environment. And the reason is that big things are complex. Big bits of work, large features, you know, 50 user stories in development, when they finish them, they hand it off to test. They're hard to test, you know. So the idea is that you limit the amount of work that each of the guys, so if you look on that Kanban board, there's effectively in progress, which is effectively dev and design, and we limit the number of items that the dev guys can have in progress to 3 in this case, and they can't start any more work until they get to done on the work that they're working on. And again, it comes back to the problem with multitasking. Most people know the problems with multitasking. You take on lots of work, you don't get anything finished. You know, and the Kanban approach explicitly limits that from happening. The other thing is that when you've got the work on the wall, if you've got bottlenecks in your process, you know, people are stuck, it makes it very visual. And project managers and the team can then swarm around that work and help to get the flow moving again. So the fourth type of Kanban, and this is the one, if you've heard of David Anderson, he wrote a book in 2005 called Agile Management, and he's just released another book called Kanban earlier this year, late last year. And he's taking that philosophy, those three principles, a step further. And it really aligns with the CMMI. If you know the CMMI, it's a maturity model for software, for organizations. But level 4 and 5, the sort of top levels of maturity, talk about having a quantitatively managed organization. So an organization that manages itself based on information, not on hearsay and guesswork. And level 5 is when an organization is continuously improving. So they're not happy with where they are now. They're continuously improving and striving for perfection. So what David Anderson's done is called out some other aspects to software development. And he's calling it Kanban, a method for evolutionary delivery, I think. But the focus of these methods to make organizations or software development organizations more efficient and more predictable back to their business. So when we say quantitatively managed, there's typically 4 measures that I see anyway with Kanban customers. They're interested in lead time. So how long does it take from an order coming in or a requirement coming in to it being delivered? And then cycle time is really from us starting on the work. So it might have been sitting there waiting to be done, but when we actually start, how long does it take before it's delivered? And then what's the variability between those times? So if we do 30 features or 30 projects, how predictable are we? You know, when we say it's going to take 5-6 weeks, what's the predictability of that? From the business, they're interested. You know, they need to know if we say 5 or 6 weeks, it's going to be 5 or 6 weeks. Or if it's not, they like to know the range of variability. And then efficiency, which is the average time to deliver work. So one of the things that David Anderson has in his books is the concept of cost of delay. So this is a way of prioritizing your work based on what it will cost if you don't have it in a certain time. So the first one is called expedite. So if you don't have that work, that project, that feature done by today, what will it cost us? Critical impact bugs, projects delivering a substantial saving, those sort of things. And then fixed delivery dates, where if we don't have it by a certain date, there will be a tangible cost. So regulatory changes, things like that, or things like having an application or your web app up in time for tech days because you've got a booth and you want to demo it to people and you know that you're going to lose orders if you don't have it by then. Must go live dates. And then what I just call standard, which is the, you know, there is a tangible cost to not having it, but it's pretty linear and it might go like that or it might go like that. But the most interesting one, I think anyway, is intangible. Intangible work, stuff you can't really work out what the return is going to be on it. That's the sort of stuff that never gets done because there's always higher priority stuff. Things like platform upgrades, you know, I would say that I work for Microsoft, you know, upgrade to SQL Server 2008 now. But it's difficult sometimes to put a sort of dollar value on doing that until it gets to the end of support and then there is. Things like just improvements, improving your environment, improving your test automation. You know, a manager will say, well, what's that going to save us? You know, those sort of things are quite intangible. What you can do with this cost of delay model, though, you can allocate capacity into your teams to do all of these types of work. And that's quite profound. You could allocate 10% capacity to do improvement work, for example, and that would be a policy that would be set by management and the teams, and that would allow you to do those things. Looking at lean manufacturing has the seven wastes of manufacturing, and they're the ones down on the left. And what Mary and Tom Poppendeck did in their book on lean software development, they've mapped them to typical wastes in software delivery. So partially done work that needs refactoring, things like that, and they call that holding inventory. Things like extra processes, you know, doing stuff that doesn't really add any value. Extra features, you know, adding stuff that really isn't needed, but it's cool to do. Task switching, the multitasking, waiting for things, waiting for information. Motion, having to go to another building to see someone or, you know, moving around. These are all wastes. And then defects, the usual waste, you know, it's rework. You know, you want to avoid defects because it adds a lot of cost on the delivery. There's another way, a simpler way of looking at it. This diagram here really shows the total cost of delivering something like a feature or a user story or what have you. The stuff that you do that adds value, that the customer is happy to pay for, that's the green stuff. The stuff that because you've done something wrong or something's happened, you know, predictably wrong or unpredictably wrong, it puts load on the team. That's called failure load and that's seen as a waste. And then there's the stuff that you have to do at the start and end of any development. Transaction costs, setting up environments, things like that. Transaction cost at the right-hand side there might be deploying manually, things like this. It takes a week to deploy. And then there's coordination costs. So the amount of time you spend just coordinating the teams. You know, Scrum's very good at that. It tries to keep it to 15 minutes a day. And then depending on how long your sprints are, you know, 10% of your development time is spent coordinating and designing and what have you. Typical examples. In lean terms, that's all waste, and the goal is to gradually reduce that so that you're spending more of your time on value-added activities. And again, there's a good test, good phrase here. Again, a good one from David Anderson. You can ask yourself, if you could, would you do it more often? And if the answer is no, it's probably not stuff in the green. Would you do more stand-ups every day? Would you do one every few hours? No, so it's not value-adding. And the idea is to reduce that waste through continuous improvement. So the next section here, so that was the four Kanbans that you typically hear about. Now we're going to talk about creating a Kanban board. So it's that modeling your process. These are the steps that I typically go through. I look at modeling. What's your process now? Do you do analysis and specifications, then development, then test, then deployment, then use acceptance test? If it is, that's what you model. What sort of work do you do? What's the sort of unit of work? Is it a user story? Is it a feature? What is it? Set WIP limits, work in progress limits, on each of those activities so that you're not multitasking and spending 6 months doing requirements analysis because the requirements engineer started on 50 requirements and never actually got any finished. You set policies. What does done mean? Typical in Scrum, you've got that. But you have that at each of those activities. So when we say that the requirement's done, what does that mean? When you say that testing's done, what does that mean? You define them. Makes it more predictable, and it makes it more higher quality. We also move resources to bottlenecks. So when we visualize the flow, for example, if there's a requirements engineer stuck on a requirement, let's help move a tester to help them. Like in the Starbucks example, the cashier moves to help the barrister. And then we define different types of work, or different types of policies for different types of work. That was the expedite and the intangible. And we say things like, we'll spend 10% of our time doing intangibles. We'll say things like, if an expedite request comes in, so, you know, a sales guy who, you know, if you can get this to a customer next Friday, we'll get $1 million or £1 million. You set up a policy of how you're going to deal with that. You might stop everyone working and then get them to work on that expedite. So what I've done here, I spent some time last week, and I got a whiteboard, and I'll mark down on the whiteboard my process. So I've got a backlog of work to do there. Then it goes into development, then into test, then deploy it, and then it's complete. So we mark that up on the wall. The work comes into the backlog there, feature A, or user story A, and it builds up. And then we put the development team on. And what they do, they take the high priority work there and pull it into development, so they start working on it. And when it's done, they move it to the right of the dashed line, so it's ready, it's a queue for the testers. So when that's done, the development will then pull another work item in. Once they've done that, the test picks up the work and starts working on it, and the work there starts flowing down the board. And what we've got here, we've got a bottleneck. We've got a bottleneck forming because the deploy guy's stuck, your build engineer's stuck on A, and it's all backing up into test, but we can see that. So we can maybe help the guys move A to complete, then the work can start flowing again. And like I said before, large batches and work in progress, working on a lot of things at once, really slow down. If you're a developer, though, you might think it's really cool because I can start on lots of things and I'll probably get them done and I'll work a bit late and what have you. But they tend to have a view of only the development part of this. You know, you ask the testers are sitting there, and at the end of the month, they're meant to get a week to test before it goes live if you do a monthly release. They're meant to get it on the Friday before the week for testing. But typically, they try and deploy it on the Monday, and it doesn't work, and then Tuesday afternoon, and it's still not working. You get it on Tuesday evening. Then on Wednesday, they've actually got 3 days to test. You know, that's the problem with batching up. So what we'll do to stop that batching happening, we'll put explicit policy, a work-in-progress limit there, of 2 work items per activity. So 2 development activities, 2 test activities, 2 deploy activities. We'll limit that explicitly. We'll put a policy in place here with sticky notes that says what done means. So before something enters the backlog, what does that mean? What do we need? You know, does it need a design? Does it need a set of requirements? Does it need, I don't know, a contact with the customer so that we can talk to them about it, whatever your process is. But we define that so it's very clear. We've got a policy here that says how we deal with expedites. So the green ticket there, again, using visual techniques, it's a different color. We'll say when a green ticket comes in, we'll stop what we're doing, and we'll make sure that works through. And all other work will stop. That's a policy. You might have another policy. You might put 10% of the team onto it. That's for you to decide. And then once that expedite's moved through, we then start flowing the work again. And it gets the N and G stuck there, but it will get there, finally. And it's done. So the next bit is really to add the team. So we didn't really see how many devs and testers we've got there. So we've got the team. We've got 2 developers, 2 testers, and a deployment engineer. A good starting WIP limit is number of people doing that activity times 2, because they might want to switch a little bit between work, and then -1. And the reason that you do -1, it tends to promote collaboration. You know, so you know, one guy's got 2 work things he's working on, another guy's got 1. The guy gets 1 done, and then he goes and helps the other guy with his 2. So he might take 1 of those. So we've limited here 2 developers times 2 -1 is 3. So they pull them in, they start working on them, they get a couple done. Put another more in, testers are working there. So the test team's got stuck, so let's get the deployment guy to help the testers. You know, he's not going to be as good as a tester, but he can certainly make tea and get pizza and things like that and just help them out a bit. You know, he might do some automation for them or see where he can help. So that got some work moving again. Then he can start deploying those 2 features. And the dev guys have got done, and they're into test again. And the deployment guy stuck again. So we moved one of the developers and one of the testers in to help the deployment guy, because we can see it blocked. So we decided in the stand-up to move some resources to the bottleneck. And the developers and testers decide, well, you know, the last time the deployment guy got blocked, it was because he was doing a lot of manual stuff. So what we can do to help is we'll automate that, so it's not as tricky next time. So the dev starts writing some automation scripts, the testers can test them. And it's still blocked, you know, the buggy automation script there. So what we can do is we can start, oops, skipped ahead there. So all devs now start helping, probably getting in the way a bit of the deployment guy, but trying to help. You've been there, obviously. And then when it's unblocked, we can start again. But again, we've got more blockages here. So we move some developers to help the testers. You know, that's always a good laugh. And problem solved, so the devs go back to their work, and the work starts to flow again, and all's happiness. And we flow the team with the work, and it's all done. And then it's back to the start. So just to be clear what we mean by lead time and cycle time. So lead time is the amount of time from when it comes into the backlog till it's done. But stuff sits in the backlog typically for a while. So we've got cycle time. Once the dev teams or the first process, the analysts or whatever, pull the work in from the backlog, we start measuring from that point. And the time from that point till it's done is called cycle time. From a viewpoint, lead time is typically what your customers care about. They don't care about how long it's been stuck in the backlog because you haven't got enough developers. That's how long they've been waiting. It's an important measure. Cycle time is more of an internal view of how efficiently you're moving work through. You need to measure both. This is where things like TFS comes in, because the sticky notes are really good. And to be honest, I've had my sticky notes where I write the backlog entry date in, and then I write the complete date in, and you know, the dev start date on the cards, and then people forget to, and you can't really calculate. You could enter them in a spreadsheet. It's nice to have this stuff automatically captured. So that's back to our real Kanban board there. Oops. So what you can see here, we've modeled our process. We've got the product backlog on the left. We've got ready, which just means that we understand the requirement and the developers are happy that they can start developing it. Then we've got in progress. So that's the stuff when the developers, and we've got in this case designers, and both developers and designers work on the stuff in progress. And then we've got the output queue of that process is really ready to test. So we're happy that we're done. And if you see the green stickies at the bottom, they're the policies. So when we've got bugs in the ready queue, we priority one or priority two, we'll always do those bug fixes before any features. And then we do features, and then we do priority three and four. And there's a definition of done there for before it's ready to test, and a one for when it's tested and done. Very clear. We're using Xbox Live avatars of the team there. Just cut that, print it out and cut out. Start on the button to show who's working on what. It's very visual. So the interesting bit, Kanban with Team Foundation Server 2010. So why not just use the board? You know, we've used the board at Microsoft with sticky notes and different colored sticky notes, and it works really well when you're all in the same place. We have rigged up webcams before, so you can have a webcam pointing at a board and someone else can see it somewhere else. You start losing it, though. It's not perfect. So for distributed teams, and the board's difficult, the physical board. Auditing, if you've got a requirement to audit things that change, the board again, you could take a photo of it every day, and then when the auditors come in, show them a few hundred photos, if they'd like to see that. So where TFS can help with that. Integrated release management, so if you want to store, as you'll all know, because you all use TFS, TFS will automatically track which work items were in a build, for example. So it allows the test team to see what they've got in that build, and all that automation starts to really pay off when you're using a system like TFS. And then the reporting, the metrics are captured automatically, the lead time, cycle time, all of that good stuff's captured automatically when you're using a tool. You need to configure TFS to capture that, but that's what I'm going to demo a little later on. But, and this is important, but a manual board's very flexible. If I want to add a new process, whiteboard rubber, rub off a line, stick another line in. I can go to Staples or Office Depot and buy some different colored stickies because there's a new policy or there's a new type of work that we're working on. That's very powerful, that flexibility. So whatever solution I'm going to talk about in a little bit of time, it's really important that that solution is flexible, that you can change it as your process changes. So three steps for configuring TFS. We're going to model our process. I'm going to make up a process, pretty typical. We've got that modeled in TFS. We're going to make it visible on a wall, not in here, but you'll see. And then we're going to use some reporting and metrics and Excel stuff to help you see those bottlenecks and help the workflow. One thing I would say, I have put all the stuff you're going to see today up on a CodePlex project. I don't know if you can read that very well. It's blue because I clicked on it. But it says techdayskanban.codeplex.com. I'll be adding features to that over time. Feel free to join as a contributor and add your bits to it as well. That would be really nice. So the first thing is, how do you model your process in TFS? Quick heads up. Do people here tend to change the process templates in TFS? Or do you? Yeah, plenty of people do, yeah. Probably about 20-30% there. A lot of customers I go to tend to use the out-of-the-box templates. They use MSF for Agile or MSF for CMMI, or they use the EMC Conchango Scrum template. That's very popular. Or the new Microsoft Scrum template, which is very easy to use. It's quite simple, but it's very, very good. They tend to use them, and they don't modify them. And that's a flaw. With Kanban thinking, you don't have the tool tell you your process. You tell the tool your process, because we want to model that, and then we want to improve it over time. So it's evolution rather than revolution. So the challenge is, if you've used the Team Foundation Server Process Editor and you understand the sort of TFS object model and things, the challenge is, where do you store those work items? How do you model that state flow? The obvious one is using the workflow states, and that's the way I do it. It seems pretty obvious, but there's a problem with it, that you can't extend the state model in TFS with things like WIP limits. So where do we store our WIP limit? You can't group together states like dev in progress and dev done. There was two states on the Kanban. You can't group them together and say that's our development activity, and it has a WIP limit of 2 or 3. There's no way in the model to do that. I'll show you a way that we can do that, but outside of TFS in a moment. The other ways that I thought of when we were talking, when I was talking about with people in the product group about this, the TFS team, we could have used things like a custom work item type called a activity, and that could have two child work items like tasks or stories. You know, you could assign it, but it really doesn't fit into the user interface of TFS. That it gets really, really awkward from a user experience point of view. The state is the natural place to go because, you know, when the developer's working on a user story and he's done, he moves the state to development done and everyone's happy. So I'm going to show you how to do it with states. Process Editor is your friend. It's got a lot better in TFS 2010 in my experience. It's more robust. It comes as a power tool. It doesn't come with TFS. You have to go and download it. There's a link to it at the end of this deck. You can install that, and then it allows you to customize your TFS process template to meet your process. So Process Editor, I'm going to spin it up in a moment, but effectively you go from the Tools menu once you've installed it. Process Editor, I want a work items type, and I want to open a work item type from the server. What I'm going to do is customize the task work item to model the Kanban process that we're talking about. You then select the work item type that you want to edit. It's got user story here. I'm going to select task in a moment. It brings up some information about the work item type. So in this case, you've got the user story, and this first tab here is fields. So when you create a new user story in TFS, they're the fields that you see, the stuff you can fill in. You can add your own, and you can modify them. This one is the workflow tab, and I'm showing the user story workflow here from MSF for Agile. And you can see it's got three states. It goes from active to resolved to closed, and there's transitions in between each one. And those transitions govern, when I'm active, which states can I transition to, and what happens when we do the transition. The out-of-the-box one isn't really modeling your process. If your process does just go active, you have a user story, then it goes active, and then it's resolved, and then it's closed, then that's cool. You could probably use it. Most people have something like user stories have to be, you know, written up, some analysis done, and then some development, and then some testing, and then some deployment. So we're going to model that. What I did here is I just went into the user story and then just blanket, control A, delete, and that'll give you a blank canvas to work from. And this is in the Kanban demo I'm going to show you, this is the workflow that I've modeled. Now, it is simplified from the one you'd really want, but it's got several stages. It goes from backlog to development done, and then down to test, and then to test done, then it goes to deploy, and then it's complete. Each of those transitions, if you look at them, the one between backlog and development there, we put some field, some automated rules in that start collecting those metrics, those lead times, and you can have TFS automatically modify fields based on transition. So if I need to store the activated date when it transitions from backlog to development, so that I can measure the cycle time from when it was actually activated to when it was closed at the end, then I can capture that data there. It looks really simple here and really clean, intentionally. That model there wouldn't allow you to go from test back into the backlog. There's no transition allowed. The real process template, you'd have to put transitions in between each state where the person's allowed to change it. And I've seen it before where you have a transition between every state. You allow people to move things about. That gives you the flexibility of the wall, because there's nothing stopping me moving my sticky note anywhere. But again, for simplicity's sake, I've kept it like that for this demo. So what does that look like in TFS? So I go to Team Explorer. Okay, up there. And I go to my Tools menu, Process Editor, Work Item Types, Open Width from Server. And I'm going to select this Tech Days 2011 project that I've created there based on MSF for Agile, and I'm going to edit the task, and it brings up the fields, and the layout is how you want the data entry form laid out. We'll preview that, so see how it looks. But the workflow is the one we're interested in. So a task in MSF for Agile, it's active, then it's closed, you know. Okay. Get rid of that. And we want to put some states on, so I'm just going to do a simple one here. Backlog. In progress. And done. Very simple process here. And put some transitions in, so there's the initial transition when I create it. There is a transition from backlog to in progress. And there's a transition from in progress and done. And what I want to do, I want to be able to capture the lead times and the cycle times. So TFS automatically stores an activated date when you create the work item. So I don't need to have to do anything in that transition there when you create it. That's automatic. It's the created by date, not the activated date. What I want to do, though, is store the date that the actual work was pulled off the backlog into in progress. So what I can do here, I can right-click, open details, and chug, and go to fields, create a new field, and that lists all the fields that are available on that work item. So what I want to do is I want to modify the activated date, and I put in the rules, and I create copy rule, and I want to copy it from the current clock to the date time, and I want to store, copy it automatically into that activated date. Click OK. And I want to do the same thing when we're done. So from in progress to done, I want to copy that into the closed date field. So it's the same thing again. Fields, new. Select the field. Go to closed date, rules, new. What am I meant to do now? Is that the halfway point indicator? Sign out, yeah. Is someone bored? So we can do, I'm not going to save this, but one of the things you have to do, it's not on my laptop, no, the sounds off. Okay, faster, 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 I get it. You've got to modify the default reasons before you can save it. Right, I'm going to... Right, all right. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. Started. And then the final transition when we're done. You need to put in reasons. The default ones, will it'll not save and validate. So we can call that done. And then I can save it. Thank you. Okay. So that now, that's a modified task process in there. What I'm going to do is just put up the next slide, sorry. So the next step really is to make the work visible. And what I've done here, remember the flexibility thing? What I've done is rather than building a SQL Server reporting services report that I could automatically render my Kanban board in and have it displayed on a wall, unless you're a SQL Server reporting services whiz, it's not very flexible. You know, you could probably work out how to create this sort of visual in SSRS. I've seen similar things done, not in the Kanban context, but having boxes and sticky note type rendering. It's a nightmare to change in my view. I'm not an MDX sort of guy. I'm not a business intelligence studio guy. So what I've done is written a very, very simple ASP.NET page that refreshes dynamically from TFS, so you can get this stuff up on the wall. And what it's showing you is it's showing you that activity there, the development, test, deploy. The yellow cards there are user stories, and the purple ones are bugs, so it's live out of TFS. And we've got a WIP limit on there, on each column, and when that's exceeded, the column goes red. So again, you can put that on a big monitor, this on a big monitor, and you can see that happening in real time. It's using an AJAX update panel. It updates every 5 seconds, so it's near real time. What's the app? It's very, very simple. It's an ASP.NET default.aspx page. It's got an ASPX or ASCX user control in there that renders one of the lanes. It's got a style sheet to do the bugs are purple, user stories are yellow. And... it's got two config files, and this is the important thing. Because going back to what I was saying before, there's nowhere in TFS to store WIP limits, and there's nowhere in the state, and there's nowhere in TFS to group two states together into an activity. So what I've got here, when you look in the app settings, there's just some simple configuration data there. The server URI of your TFS server, that's on a VM, it's called TFS 2010. The name of the TFS collection, the project name, Tech Days 2011, you saw that before. And what work items do I want to display on the board? Just comma-separated list. And then there's this Kanban config file. And it's just a set of what I've called lane definitions. And they effectively define what's going to get rendered. So that first one, backlog, it maps to a single TFS state called backlog. The next one, development, maps to two TFS states. And those states are named development and development done. I've got a type in there. One means that it's in progress, the left hand of the dashed line. And the one on the right hand side, development done, is effectively a queue for the test team. So it's very simple. I'll show you how that works now. So Visual Studio and Solution Explorer, I've got it in there. You know, it's real. Default ASPX page. You've got the Kanban config, so you can modify this to map it to your process. And you've got the web.config, you can point that at your TFS project. And if I spin it up, F5, warmed up there it is. And I'm going to be tweaking this over the next coming weeks to make the CSS a little bit more resize friendly. But if I bring up TFS next to it, and go to Team Explorer, and let's say I'm a tester, and I've finished testing the logout. So if I've got a few queries I've written here, backlog, in progress and complete. And if I look at the in progress items and I find the logout, I get a choice of states then. Remember, I only had a transition between test and test done. So that's the only choice I get. And so I'm Claire and I've finished testing. And I save that. And that updates on the board straight away. So you could put this web server on your TFS box and you could have different teams in different places with it up on a screen. And then they can see the actual real-time view of the work and where it is and have their stand-ups around it. The reason that I think it's more valuable than having a real fully featured Silverlight WPF Ajax drag and drop experience is that it's simple and it's flexible. As an ASP.NET developer, I can easily add stuff in there. You know, I can add extra rows or columns or, you know, make it, you know, put graphs on there or whatever. It's very simple, it's very flexible. So the next section here is really about helping the workflow. And in TFS, there's two places where you get information from in the database. One is a cube, the analysis database, and one is the a relational database called TFS Warehouse that stores very similar aggregated data that the cube stores, but it's accessible via regular SQL expressions. And I'm going to show four different diagrams that I think are charts that are useful in Kanban systems. The first and probably the most popular is called a cumulative flow diagram. Now what this is showing, it's showing how many work items we've got in each state every day over time. And that looks pretty healthy. Works flowing through the different states. You can see there on the right, that's our model that we've got in the Tech Days 2011 project. And if you measure the gap between backlog and deployed, it's actually between analysis and deployed there, the pink lane and the blue lane at the bottom. That effectively tells us how much WIP we've got. So looking at the scale on the left, we've got probably about between 12 and 21. We've got a lot of work in progress across the whole team. The thickness of each of those lanes shows you the amount of work in progress per activity, effectively. So the orange and blue, or sort of cyan one, is the development done. That shows you how much WIP and the dev team have. So again, it's a good report for monitoring how much WIP the project's got without having to go into TFS and run queries. You could just look at this. And the other thing it tells you is lead time there. So a sort of average lead time. So it looks from when work items go into the pink state, which is analysis, to the time that they go into deploy. And that's a sort of aggregated view of what your lead time is. Another useful diagram is just throughput. So this is weekly. So how many, every week, how many items have we got to go to deployed state? And again, we can put a sort of trend line in there to see if we're, you know, getting faster, getting slower on average, that sort of thing. At a weekly level, it's quite high level. And then this shows us how much work in progress we've got on a daily basis. And again, a trend line. We're taking more and more work in progress. So that would, I usually say metrics drive conversations. So if I was a project manager looking at this, I would say, well, why is that? Let's go and speak. Are we taking on too much work? Or have we actually added some new developers and we can take on more work because of that? So I'd like to see how that changes over time. And how it changes based on what changes we make to our process and what changes we make to our team. So the last one here, and it's probably the most interesting, is called a statistical process control chart. And this really answers two questions. And the first one is, how predictable are we as a team? And the second one is, how efficient are we, or how effective at delivery are we? And what it's plotting here, it's plotting the lead time for each of the work items that we're tracking, so the use cases or user stories in this example. How long did they take from going into the backlog till them being done? And the dashed line in the middle is the average. So if someone came to me and says, on the whole, how long does it take this team to do a user story? I'd say probably around 18, 19 days lead time. At the bottom, though, which is the cycle time, I'd say, well, actually, once they start working, it's going to take them about, is that 12 days on average? Okay, that's cool. But notice that, you know, about 30% of them are more than that, a bit more than 30% there. So what we're saying is that the spread of predictability is quite large. So some take 30 days, some just took 5 lead time. It's interesting information because it tells me we're not very consistent, but are we measuring apples and oranges here? You know, some of the user stories were, you know, 14 or 13 story points, and some were 2 and 1. So what we can do is we can filter this information and say, look at particular types of work. You might create a new work item type called sales, high priority sales work item or high priority project. And you can then filter the data and say, for high priority projects or, for example, for 13-point user stories, how predictable are we? So you can filter that data. It's very useful. As you continuously improve, do you bring those points on that scatter chart? Do they start going towards the mean, the average along the middle there? And that shows that you're becoming more predictable. The lines at the top and bottom of those are called upper and lower control limits, and they're calculated based on 2 times standard deviation. So they're the 95th percentile. So if you were saying, if you're using a standard deviation for estimating how predictable you are, or what's the range, the likelihood of something taking, you know, the time we say, then I would say that we're going to take between, at the top, between 3 and 35 days, typically there, second standard deviation, and the same on the cycle time. So, another demo here. So, what I've got an Excel spreadsheet here with these in, and there's a guide on how to configure it to point to your data that shows the cumulative flow diagram there. What that is pointing at the TFS warehouse, the cube, and it's just pulling back all of the work item data there and graphing it based on state. So it produces that cumulative flow. And then it's sorted. When you actually point Excel at TFS to generate this sort of plot, you'll see all of the work item states coming back in a random order. I think it might be alphabetical. So what you have to do is go into there and reorganize them in here so that they're in order. Otherwise, you'll get spikes and jags in the graphic. Throughput, again, it's the TFS warehouse that's pulling this back. So no big deal here, you know, just grouping them. Work items that are deployed, or sorry, user stories that are deployed per week, that shows throughput. The WIP limit, again, TFS warehouse. I'm only selecting certain states, though. Oops. So what it's showing me is just the work that's in the in-progress state. So from analysis to test done, I think, was the to deploy was the in-progress. So it excludes things in the backlog and things in the complete state. And then the lead cycle times, this is a bit different. This is actually pointing at the TFS relational database because I don't want an aggregated view here. I want actually each individual work item to come back. And what I've done, I've created a connection from within Excel. This may not work. Yeah, it has worked. It'll not work if I run it. I was messing around with my TFS VM before this, and I've broken something. What it's doing, it's running a query here. And it's just bringing back all of the work items that are completed. But it's also measuring the lead times and the cycle times. When I was showing you the TFS process editor, those extra rules that I put in to store those times allow us to pull back this data. I can't work out a way of getting lead times and cycle times in a per item way, per work item way, out of the cube. I think they're aggregated away in the cube. If someone, you know, mail me if you know how to do it. So what I'm using here is the TFS relational database to get that out, and I can just write a SQL query. I'm a SQL programmer, so I can just write a SQL query, and it also returns back, if you look back at the data, the story points. So I was saying before, you know, looking at that spread, it could be massive user stories or tiny ones. I can just filter this. It's not particularly interesting test data, but I can just say, show me the ones. How predictable are we on one user story? And it's made up data, so it's terrible that it takes 30 days to do some one user story point things. But you can see that you can use the relational database to pull back this type of information and calculate those backlog dates, the date it went in the backlog, the in-progress date, and the date that it was actually done. So I've taken you through what Kanban is, where it's useful, how you can customize TFS to support it. And these are the key sort of points to take away. Kanban brings the team together through visualization of work. And it helps them collaborate because when they see a problem visually, they can then discuss how they're going to solve it as a team rather than as individuals or as silos, the devs. You know, the devs, we're not going to help testers. You know, we're devs. The testers say, no, we're not going to help devs. We can't code. You know, that sort of thing. So it helps the collaboration happen. Arguably, it helps increase customer satisfaction because those lead time figures are a real indicator from when the customer orders something or it goes in the backlog to how predictable it is getting out. You can see that data. That's how your customers see you. And things like using the policies, helps explicit policies, helps increase the quality of the software because you make it clear to everyone on the team what's expected before you move it down the board. The next thing is really that TFS 2010 can support Kanban. There are other tools coming out on the market that do Kanban, drag and drop. There's things like LeanKit Kanban and Kanbanery and things like that. And they're great tools, and they're all Silverlight and Ajax, and you can drag and drop them. But they're their own database at the back end, you know. They're not linking into your build processes or SSRS and things like that. So it really can support Kanban, and it's great at getting that all up visualization of the work using the cube in TFS. Because I can bring in all sorts of other quality metrics onto those reports, you know, like the test pass fail rates and things like that as well. The last point is really that a digital Kanban board, so when you make it electronic, it gives you that automation and it supports geo-distributed teams, but you do lose some flexibility. You know, the board and the sticky notes is the most flexible way of doing it. So if you're in a situation where you do need to do the auditing and the build automation and tie it all together, but you need flexibility, so the ASP.NET app, dead easy to use, dead easy to change, then it's a good meeting point, let's call it that, rather than a halfway house. It's very good. So on the resources, and again, I've clicked them all, so they're all blue. TechDaysKanban.codeplex.com is where I've uploaded all of the, I've created a TFS process template with all of the changes that I've put in packaged together, so you can deploy that under your TFS. There's a link, Kanban 101. It's a very good site that explains what type 3 Kanban is. You know, visualize the work, limit work in progress to help the flow. Limited Whip Society is a group of Kanban thought leaders that all aggregate their blogs onto there, and it's got, again, more information about the more quantitative and continuous improvement aspects of the Kanban type 4, as I described it. TFS Power Tools, March 2011 version, is on there, and the ALM Rangers MSDN page, so you can see what sort of stuff we do. There's 5-6 books there at the bottom. The Kanban book on the left is the David Anderson book. It's fairly new out. It goes through the Type 4 Kanban. Very good stuff. Leading Lean Software Development, I'd recommend that. It's Mary and Tom Poppendeck. They talk about Lean more broadly, so they go into what waste is and conceptual integrity of software and things like that. Principles of Product Development Flow by Don Reinerston has the maths behind it all. It's very good. If you're into maths, if you're into the actual underlying theory of why this stuff works, that's an excellent book, and it's 2009, I think it's recent. Agile Management, again, another David Anderson book from 2005, talks about, again, more of the maths behind this stuff from when he was at Microsoft and then Corbis, when he first started rolling Kanban systems out for software. The Goal is a book by Eli Goldratt that talks about how to remove bottlenecks from your processes. So the thing called Theory of Constraints, which is a formal method for identifying and removing bottlenecks in your process and getting stuff flowing. And then the sort of granddaddy of them all, Edward Deming, he was the guy that got sent to Japan after World War II by the Americans to help Japan rebuild. And he was a management scientist. And all of the stuff you hear, like Toyota Production System, Lean, TQM, Six Sigma, Agile, you could argue, all goes back to him and some of his colleagues at the time. Very interesting book to read. So on that note, there's some slides here that tell you how to stay up to date with MSDN in Belgium, or Belux, Belgium, Luxembourg. And you can watch Tech Days 2011 on demand, I guess, when you've gone home and it's all been uploaded. Thank you. Any questions? Any questions or comments, or have you been using Kanban yourself? You have been using Kanban or haven't been using Kanban? Is it something that you'd be interested in trying out? I don't know. Yeah. Do you use TFS? So it's something you might look at that. Someone must have a question. Come on, tell me this is rubbish and it'll never work. Hi. So the question is, how do you measure development productivity for the individual developer? I guess you've got to first start by defining what you mean by productivity. So if you start measuring the productivity of developers in the development activity and make those measures very visible to the developers and everyone else, you might be tempted to do something like set a target. So if I can do, you know, I have a developer, he's called Adam, and he can do about 3 user story points worth of work a day. And I don't think that's good enough. And I want to make him do 5 a day. So I'm going to set him a target to do that. And then what I'm going to do is give him a pay rise if he gets to 5 for consistently for 3 months to incentivize him a bit. Because I think he's lazy, and I'm sure he can do 5 if we give him a target. What will typically happen is he'll release stuff to test. He'll start ignoring the policies. You know, what does done mean? He'll release code to testers. The testers will then start getting angry because the code that they got to test wasn't really testable. So rework will start, and if you go back to that diagram with the green and the red and failure load and value, you'll start seeing a lot of failure load coming in. And it might be because of that target and what you've tried to do. You should be measuring the lead times and cycle times. It's the productivity of the team, not of individuals. So I guess that's sort of skirting around your question, is how do we measure development productivity? So you can, but you've got to question whether you want to. You want to measure the productivity of the team, not of the developer, in my view. And Edward Deming, if you read the book. is that a sufficient answer? Yeah, sorry. Any more comments or thoughts? Or
handle reworks, like you send something in testing, mm-hmm. Testing is not correct, and you have to send it back to development.
Yeah.
This transaction is only like from left to right.
Yes.
How can you handle this?
Yes, so how do you handle when something goes to test and then it requires rework? There's 2 ways that are typically used. One is to move it back to the input queue of the development team and stick a red sticker on it, or a bug, so you can see that the bug is related. So this is, if you're going to do it with sticky notes, and you've got a yellow sticky note, which is the feature that was tested, and you might attach a little red sticky note onto it, which represents the bug, and move it back to ready. Or you might leave it in the test and have the red sticker on it there, which is the bug. And you move the developers to the test activity. They're refixing, it's rework. The key thing, and this is where TFS really makes it easier, is that you'll be measuring that. You know, you'll be storing it. You'll be saying things like, look, every project we do, we get 50 bugs, you know, or we get 100 bugs. And if you've got that data, then you can start continuously improving. You can ask yourself, why is that? You know, did the requirements come in? Were they clear? You know, why was that? Did our test automation, did it not work? And it's, you know, giving false positives or false negatives, true negatives. You know, you can start asking those sort of questions and having those conversations with the data. Personally, I prefer to move the sticky note back to the input queue, but just as a bug, a red one. And then I have a policy. So if that was like the ready queue, I then have a policy that says that we do bugs first. Yeah, we don't let bugs build up. It's work in progress. It's inventory in lean terms. You know, it's refactoring is another type of waste. We make it visual on the board, and you can see if you've got a lot of work to do. And I will stop teams from building cool features until the bugs are off the board. But again, you do that through policy. You agree with them. It's not me beating them with a stick. You know, it's me saying, look, do we agree that it's good not to have bugs going downstream to the deployment guy or testers? Yes, most people agree it is. So let's do those first. And if you, I worked with a team, and I'll not say who it was, and they implemented a Kanban board with sticky notes, and I went over to it, and there was no red sticky notes, there were no bugs. You know, there was one or two sitting there. And I went to the test lead, and I said, wow, this is great. You know, really, everything's cooking, obviously, so on. And I said, it's about 100 bugs. But we didn't have enough sticky notes, and it was using up all the space on the board, so we stopped putting them there. She hadn't drank the Kool-Aid, as the Americans would say. She hadn't got the philosophy. Those numbers should have been on the board, because then we might have done something about it and asked the question, why is that? The five whys, you know, it's a Toyota way that they used to use to get to the root cause of something. Ask why five times. You know, why have we got the bugs there? Because the developers wrote crappy code. Why was that? Because you got to develop, we didn't have the right tools, you know, or the requirements were poor. Why was that? Because we haven't got a good engagement with I'm a consultant, so with our customer that wants the system built. Why is that? Because we didn't have a conversation at the start of the project that put effectively a product owner in from the customer. Ah, that's what we need to do. We need to get someone from the customer that's engaged in the project, that helps us get good requirements that are prioritized correctly, that helps the developers write cleaner code, that stops the bugs happening in test. Does that answer your question? Can't actually remember what the original question was. I'm rambling on. Sorry. Yes, you can either leave it there with a red stick or move it back up, and you need a state transition to allow that to happen. Yeah. Cool. Any other thoughts? Hi.
Could you give an example definition of development done, a policy?
Yeah, development done. So the development done might be that the all of the requirements that were defined have been implemented for that user story. It may be that TFS has been updated with the time it took to do it, or you know, that sort of thing. It could be that I've had a conversation as a developer. When I say I'm done, I've had a conversation with the analyst that wrote the requirement. We've agreed that it implements it correctly. And then I've had a conversation with the tester that's going to do it, and he's agreed that it's testable, and he can test it, and he understands how to test it. And then I might say that it's been reviewed by a peer, so it's been code reviewed. And then I might say that it's been reviewed against our security procedures, so it's had something like the security development lifecycle stuff done to it, so it's been threat modeled and what have you. You could have a big long list, yeah? Well, that would be my starting point. Is that okay? Thank you. So we've got another 5 minutes left, I guess. Any more comments? Sorry, who was that? Hi.
The purple sticky note.
Yeah.
Was that
on the photo that I put up of the Kanban board?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they were impediments. So if you use the Scrum template, so these guys with that picture, so I'll try and skip back to it. They were using the Microsoft Scrum template, and that has a work item type called an impediment that our project manager, that's his to-do list. And what we were using on the photo, if I can skip back, the purple tickets represent, there's so many slides in here, hang on. So the purple tickets represent impediments, and what we were doing, it's better. No. What we were doing, we were logging them on the board so the project manager could see them, and they were in TFS, so you could see them if it was remotely. There it is there. So those, there's three actual, the ones in the middle there are three impediments with the TFS ID written on them. What happened was initially we stick them on the card, so the user story, the yellow ticket, when there's an impediment, but it's not blocked yet. It's just we're waiting for something or there's a problem somewhere, but we can still keep working on it. And then once the actual work item's blocked, the user story, we typically will move the user story, the whole user story down with those three tickets on. Those impediments there aren't related to a user story. That's why they're not on a yellowed note.
I think I meant another slide.
Ah, sorry. Ah, sorry, the expedite. Yes, yes, yes. So the expedite ticket, again, that requires a policy to be defined by the organization to define a situation. It was this one, wasn't it? A situation where, as the management team, I want to be able to stop all of the work or have a piece of work that I want them to get through as quickly as possible. And I'll have a policy around that. So it may be that we're only allowed to do one of those a month, but that will be explicit. So on the policy, the little white tickets there, you'll have a policy, you can't see it on that slide, the one on the left that says, if an expedite ticket comes in, we will stop what we're doing and work it through. We will allow ourselves to exceed WIP limits to do that. But we'll measure it once, so we've got some data. If these are coming in every week, you've got a problem. Yeah, you need to look at your process. If they're more random occurrences, then you've got to have a policy in place. The team's ready. You might put some more thorough risk mitigation policies in place. For example, you can double the testers, you know, if you're going to rush it through, that sort of thing. But it's explicit. That's the key thing with Kanban. It's explicit. Is that okay? Was there someone up here I think I saw? Sorry, I can't see for the lights. Hi. So the question was, is if you're working on, if an individual is working across multiple projects, can you manage it in TFS? So forgetting Kanban for a moment, yeah, can TFS, can you do that? Yes, you can. Yeah, you know you can do that. The way that you can balance it is by setting WIP limits. So if you've got a, I think on this example I had a WIP limit of 2 at the top there, because that's because we've got a dedicated one developer on, you know, times by 2, that's a sort of good WIP limit start. If he was balanced across 2 projects 50% of the time, then you can have a lower WIP limit on each project. I've seen that done. With an explicit policy about when he's going to work on things. So it comes back to that, see on the bottom, the second policy along, what controls when a developer pulls stuff off the backlog? That policy's defined. So if he works on a Monday, Tuesday, and a Wednesday morning on one project and the other time on another project, then it could have that clearly on the policy that there will be no work done. And then it becomes a capacity management issue. And effectively, he's now multitasking across multiple projects, which is quite inefficient anyway. You know, there's a number that says that multitasking typically costs 20% of the day. If you're multitasking, does that answer? That's probably not the best answer, but it's really a capacity planning issue and making the policies explicit. Thanks. Hi.
You can also use it to make the result more explicit.
Adapt the situation. Oh, I mean, at Microsoft Services in the UK, they're working on a government project. But they're doing maintenance on it as well as new features. And the customer wants all the new features and he wants all the maintenance done. They've got a fixed team that the customer's paying for. And they're using Kanban to make that bloody obvious to the customer that they can't do all those things at once. Yeah, it's a good comment, though. It is. Guess we're almost up. Hi. Yes, so the question was, do we put spikes into TFS? By that, you meaning like extreme programming architectural spikes, you know, like investigative work? Absolutely. On that whiteboard one before, there was some work around performance profiling, the target environment. We were developing an application based on Silverlight Pivot Viewer, and it was going to be running with a lot of data, and we needed to do some spike work, absolutely. What you might want to do is have a different work item type called spike rather than user story.
It will go through a different workflow.
Yeah, so we're getting advanced now. So I wish I'd brought some photos up of more advanced Kanban boards. But for parallel work, so a classic example of parallel work, and of course the time, is where you've got a developer and a designer working at the same time on something. The way that I've seen it done is you effectively have the dev, by dev I mean develop and design in Blend or whatever, but they split into two horizontal lanes within progress and done, and they effectively loop back in. The cards loop back in until they're both done, and then they go to a separate output queue. So that's where, so Kanban, you can run work in parallel, and that's the great thing, the flexibility that it gives you using the sticky notes. You can adapt this stuff. You could argue that with the ASP.NET app, it's not hard to add a new horizontal lane in there as well. You can also use things like horizontal lanes to represent specific priorities of work. So all of the high priority stuff goes along one horizontal lane, all the low priority another. You might have things like architectural spike work that doesn't need to be tested. So you have that policy there, so the test bit of it would be, you know, put black lines through it, so it doesn't need to go through that until it's done. Does that answer your? Yeah, cheers. Cool, thank you, everyone. I'm going to hang around a little bit afterwards if someone wants to talk about it or give me some feedback. Thank you.